Hello, and welcome to Selective Hearing, a space for honesty, healing, and transformation. I'm Julie DeMar, author, filmmaker, and host of this podcast. We've all practiced selective hearing. This podcast is about more than just a conversation. It's about breaking barriers, fostering understanding, and stepping into the best versions of ourselves. So take a deep breath, open your heart, and join me. What does selective hearing mean to you? Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Happy Monday. I hope that you all enjoyed your weekend. I have a very, very beautiful conversation in store for you today. I am here with Madhvi, and she is a physician assistant, and we are going to have a conversation about the journey that we all take to self-acceptance. So thank you for being here with me today.
Thank you, Julie, for having me.
I'm so excited for this conversation, because if there's one thing we can all relate to is the things that we experience at one or another time while we're on these paths. So I just want to open up the show right away and ask you to share your story and how all of this got started for you.
So I grew up in India. Childhood generally wasn't the worst by any means, but in retrospect, it seems like it did have a big influence on me. So growing up, I had parents who had the best of intentions, but they were a wee bit domineering, especially my dad. And the way we were raised, I have two other sisters, and the way we were generally raised, and this is how I remember, is that you have to be seen, you have to make your mark in the world, but do so without being heard. So everything from there followed that path where it was, you have to excel in everything, always try to be perfect, but also know along the way that you will never be perfect enough. So as a child, that puts a lot of pressure on wanting always to be in the good shoes of whoever it is that you come across. And so it was just, and being the oldest, I did carry a lot of that pressure. And I just went on with life thinking that is the way to be. My sister right below me, she's 18 months younger than me, had severe ADHD. And at that time, we did in India especially, we did not know what ADHD was. So her way of learning was very, very different from mine. But she was always compared to me. So that made me want to be better, be more perfect than I already was trying to be. So that put a lot of pressure on me. Another set of events that left a big mark on me was my parents constantly fighting and me being the reconciler every time something happened between them. And, you know, I think that also leaves an indelible mark on your psyche as you get to older, but I didn't know that until I was way past 35 and when I realized it. Another set of events was I saw a few deaths in my family. Some were beautiful, some were, you know, you just move on with life, and some were not so good. So when I was about 6 years old, my mom had severe thyroid disease, and she was told that she wouldn't carry a pregnancy to term. But she did. But then I think we lost our sister to metabolic disease at 2 months. So that was something that I saw. But at that time, it was kind of in India, death, especially in Hinduism and its other sects or religions, death is like an integral part of life. It's not something that you don't ever want in your life. It's just something that happens. You kind of grieve the loss of the person you've lost, you mourn them, but then you also move on because that's part of the circle of life. So that's how it was with my 2-month-old sister. When I was about 7 or 8, we had a nanny in our house. She was our help, but she was everything. She had a severe asthma attack while she was with us, and we didn't have all the treatments possible for her. And I saw her sort of suffocating herself to death. So literally still a very, very vivid experience for me. And then after we lost her a couple of a week, or I don't know how many of us, some days later, we had to travel to her hometown to give her belongings to her family members. And I went with my mom, and that kind of experience stayed with me. But the family was very grateful for giving her a place in our house, and so that was beautiful in some sense. And then when I was in my teens, my great grandfather, who was way over 100 in my head, I think he was 103, 104, he decided he'd had enough of life. So he, what I call willful death, is what he chose. So over 3 to 4 days, he first gave up all his medicines. The next day, he gave up eating. The third day, he gave up drinking. And by the fourth or fifth day, he was gone. But then his mourning was very beautiful. We take about 2 weeks for the whole ritual to unfold. So the first few days are more for mourning a lot, and then it kind of, it goes out into the community, and only then the immediate family members mourn, depending upon the age and kind of the importance of that person in your life. And then it's you come together as a community for a big meal where people, where all family members are invited, but extended also, like if you're remotely related to somebody, they're all there. And then even people from the community come. So you see the full circle of life. And to me, that was just awesome to see. Like that, we come together like this in death. When I was about 18, my dad had a severe stroke and he was left paralyzed from neck down. My mom became the primary caregiver. I became the primary breadwinner. And for 2 years, he was at our house and he was taken care of with a combination of allopathic medicine, along with the conventional treatments that India had to offer, the traditional treatments, Ayurvedic diet, community support, all of that. And my mom became like devoted to his care. And he passed away 2 years later, but without a single complication from being bedridden for 2 years. So not even a small bed sore. So I saw what caregiving can do, appropriate caregiving to the patient, but also to the extended family, because my sister and I kind of felt neglected in that process, and that had its own set of implications in my life. I won't speak for my sisters, but it had its own set of implications in my life, which I then had to work towards healing further down the road. And then I came to, and then I, the other thing I always knew growing up was that I was going to come to America, I was going to practice medicine, and I was going to meditate. And all of that happened through marriage, where I came to America and then my life afterwards.
Well, that is a great start to sharing your story. You know, when you were talking, I was thinking about, so I don't know if during the pre-show that I shared with you that my husband is actually West Indian. So his
Okay.
family came from India, his grandparents, to Jamaica specifically. His father was born in Jamaica, and then my husband was born in America. So I had the opportunity to attend his grandmother's funeral when she passed on. And I always share that that was probably the most beautiful experience that I ever had in life, witnessing how a community and a family came together to celebrate someone's life and to welcome, like journey them on to the next phase after they transition. And it was like the colors and the music and the flowers. The flowers, oh my gosh. And I always talk about that because his grandmother was so kind to me and I loved her dearly. And the beauty and the care that they even showed and respect and honor to her moving on from this life. It's something that I'll always, I was like, I couldn't even really truly be sad in those moments because I was in complete awe of how everything was structured. And I came in maybe 7 days after she passed, everything was already going on when I arrived, as far as, celebrating the traditions and the rituals. But It was definitely an experience for me that I'll always remember.
So in death, when someone like a grandmother who's had a very good life, a grandparent who's had a very good life, we don't have, we will miss them and we will treasure their memories, but at the same time, we don't have to be sad about them moving on because that's just part of life. So if, but the thing is that we have to learn to live life in order to accept and understand, first understand and then accept that everything, that nothing is permanent, that no one stays forever, right? Like none of us are going to be here forever. So we are all going to leave this earth. So let's just kind of be accept it and then make it beautiful so that we learn what we need to learn and live life without regrets and find the closures and understand all that, all the negative emotions along with the beautiful part of it and journey through life that way.
It was nice hearing you speak about that because I was like, oh wow, I had that experience. And when you were talking, I'm like having vivid like memories pop back into my head of just how everything was carried out. And I was like, wow, that it was very beautiful. And she did live a big, beautiful life. She had a lot of kids, a lot of grandkids. She was a beautiful woman.
And it's so beautiful for the grandchildren to see that because it helps them become bigger, better people. So my in-laws, when they passed away, my kids were like late teens, mid-teens to late teens, and they remained with their grandparents till the very end. And they saw the entire family coming out together and having a huge celebration. Yes, you're sitting there and crying and remembering the memories and all of that, but then you're also interacting with so many of your aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews that you just can't but help love life, right?
Yes. So we're going to talk about how profound, because I believe your journey is so profound, and you getting to the point of self-acceptance is that as well. So, what was that pivotal moment? Because I always like to know when you're like, okay, I'm going to make some changes in my life. And I'm also, in addition, going to integrate what I know with medicine and meditation into this healing process that I am embracing.
So I can come up with one pivotal moment, but I also think and believe, and I feel like I know within myself that everything that happened in life kind of led to that. So as a child, as I was being raised by narcissistic parents who were straddling between like being Indian against the colonial world in which India was steeped in at that time in the 60s and 70s, even up to the 80s, and my dad was very much a part of it. Being raised by them and seeing the, I call it unfair. Initially, I was calling it injustice, but I think it's just unfairness. They did not know beyond a certain point, or they did not put enough thought that this is how children should be taken care of. I knew that I had to remain a witness to all of this happening in my life until the time came when I would understand it. So I knew that from the very beginning that I just had to continue to be an observer in this, kind of go through this experience. And then at some point, there will be light at the end of the tunnel where I won't feel so abused anymore. One of the things that happened in my childhood was also that we were sent to a boarding school. So at home, we grew up in a religion called Jainism. It's similar to Buddhism in that it's more scientific and it's more like an atheistic religion where there is, instead of like the imaginary God, the God himself, like Buddha, for example, he is a perfect human being. So he evolved into that perfect human being. And that happens by taking, you have to believe in reincarnation, which is okay if you don't, but it's like you continue to come onto this into life to learn your lessons until you are this perfect human being. So I grew up in Jainism where the emphasis is on nonviolence. In that practice, though, you learn to inculcate within yourself a lot of guilt. So even if you do this, your diet is surrounded around not eating certain foods, because they if they can grow into that, like a potato grows into a potato, right? Like a it's a root. So ginger can also grow into another ginger. So those kind of foods we did not eat because it was killing life in a certain way. We had to do a lot of penance, so fasting and all of that was a huge part of it. And then we were sent to a Catholic boarding school where guilt is played out in a different way, but it's all about guilt, right? So you are never good enough. You'll never be good enough, and you just keep on striving, and you just keep on feeling bad until you die, kind of thing. So I took on all of that in myself as well. Maybe I was just a sensitive child who was observant to all of this. So I was observing all of that, and because of that guilt, I had very, very, and because of my upbringing, I had very little self-esteem. And always it was like, I'm never perfect enough, and why can't I be perfect enough? So I was sacrificing fun, being with friends, watching movies, just being a normal kid, to kind of work on myself on the side. So I would spend hours in the temple or in the chapel, for example, or I would spend even my playtime studying, for example, trying to get good grades, and I never got good grades. So that made me feel even more bad that I wasn't good enough. So all of that I was carrying with me into my body, into my psyche, and into my physical being. And then observing my sister being reprimanded with her ADHD, that she couldn't remember if she was taught 2 + 2 and then 3 + 3 on the next page, she couldn't remember 2 + 2 because her brain was working completely differently. She was not the nerd that I was. She was not there to impress people. She was there to have fun. And I was watching that. And if she was getting scolded, then I was avoiding everything to not get scolded. So all of that I carried with me, but the outcome of that was that I was constantly bullied by my classmates, my schoolmates, all of that. Somewhere I knew that this would continue to happen until I got to a point where I had to decide that I'm not going to get bullied, but I didn't know how to get there. My life along the way then was coming to America from an arranged marriage, which my mom had decided that I was to get married. And that was also against my wishes. But I accepted it just because you're a child, you're a kid, you're naive, and this is what you do, is how I got there. My husband's family amazingly worked out for me. Very, very awesome people. But it was a culture shock for me because they came from a completely different mindset. They were traditionally rooted Indians, but they were very progressive socially, versus my family was straddling that Indian colonial culture, but they were very, very not progressive. They were very controlling, narcissistic. They just wanted you to be a certain way, and it wasn't working out for me. And being immigrants, you have your family staying with you. So my in-laws were also staying with me, as was my mom, because that's what you do, right? Like, my mom didn't have a place to go, so she came to stay with me. And when my daughter was about 11, 12 years old, in our house, my mom came to me and said she did not brush her teeth. And she was very, very controlling and manipulative of my children as well. So she was trying to do everything for everybody and just control the entire household. And when she said that, there's context around it, but when she said that she hadn't brushed her teeth and she needs to come right up to brush her teeth and do this and do this and do this, I decided this is enough. I do not want to lose my, if I continue like this. And I saw myself in her. I saw her in me at that moment, saying that this is how my daughter should be listening to me as well. But fortunately, something happened, and I said, if I continue to do this, I am going to lose my children the way I was lost to my parents. Because I do not, at this point or beginning then, the emotional connection with my parents was beginning to fade away. And I did not want that. I did not want my children to be felt abandoned by their parents. No, if they go off on their own and they want nothing to do with me, that's on them. But I did not want to play a role in it. And that was my pivotal moment saying, I need to change it. And then the next thing that happened, meditation came into my life, but we can wait on that.
I relate to that so much because I was kind of just unknowingly walking along this path, doing everything my parents did. And then it was like I became a mom and I was like, whoa, I can't do this because I don't want my kids to feel the way that I feel. And I'm going to be committed to it because of that. And I think that children are beautiful for changing mindsets. Some people just look at kids like, oh, those are just kids. But I don't think that they realize how truly incredible they are and the very, very important and intricate part that they play in life, especially when it comes to changing generational cycles. So I really related to that. So I had to say that to you.
Thank you. And the other thing, Julie, while you were talking, is the difference in parenting between my family and the way my husband's family was raised. My husband also has severe ADHD. He's the youngest of six, but never as a child did he feel that he was less than anything that he was. It's only when I came into his life that he realized that he wasn't the perfect human being he thought he was. I say I'm sort of his karma kind of thing, just because he's beginning to realize he's not, or not realize, but he started knowing that he's not perfect. But when parents have that relationship with their children, where you learn from the children as much as you are responsible for them as a parent, individuals preserve a little bit of their innocence, their mischievousness, their kindness, their compassion. They preserve all of that. And my husband is a very kind, compassionate person. There is, and in all his siblings, I see a lot of naughtiness sometimes that comes into play. And my children also can be like that. And I just love that about give that they have that in them. And they can come to us and be mischievous because humor is everything in life, right? Like, we don't have to take ourselves so seriously. And we don't have to be the authority on everything. We can be told that I don't know something. That mom, you're old-fashioned, or mom, you're this, or mom, you can stay quiet now. It's okay. And I like that about, and I see that in children who've had good upbringing, even if they're adults now.
Yeah, my 6-year-old calls me out all the time, and I'm like, okay. He, the other day, I'll share a story with you, a quick, funny story. I was dropping him off at school, and we were in school. I always walk my kids in school, give them a hug, tell them to have a great day. So we're standing at his locker. He's getting all his things to take into the classroom, and I'm talking to another mom, and she says, like, she's like, oh, I don't want to offend anyone. And my 6-year-old goes, m'offended? What's m'offended mean? And she's like, m'offended. And he was like, does that mean we eat for breakfast muffins with scrambled eggs?
So
And it
it's
changed
about that,
everything.
right? It's just like it can go in so many different directions without any attachments, which is amazing.
Yes, it made us laugh and laugh. And then
It's a new word.
when he went inside, she was like, muffined. She was like, I'm getting a sign made for my house, muffins with scrambled eggs.
Hey, there you go.
And I was like, it's beautiful, isn't it? And she was like, I just love his innocence. But that is definitely that thing where when I have all the negativity that was ingrained in me creeping up and talking to me, saying, am I doing it good enough? Am I acting just like my mom? All the things. Then I look at my kids' actions and I'm like, no, shut it down. You're actually doing a really good job. So,
The grace that you have to give to yourself. But that doesn't come overnight.
No, it doesn't. So, there's something that I want to mention. I highlighted it in my notes because you mentioned feeling like many different people in one body before your healing work. So, the way that I kind of perceive that is like the stages we go through when, for me, like at one point in my life, I was this type of person. And then the next part, I was this kind of person. Then I became a mom. I became this kind of person. And then I started healing. So I grew into this type of person. So I want to know what that means for you and what this was like. How did you navigate this transformation?
With a lot of turmoil. Through meditation, I've learned that the road to peace is a violent one for the self. It's not easy, right? It's so much is bubbling up. Like all the things that we kind of carry with us just gets layered, it's like layer upon layer upon layer. And whenever something surfaces, we are taught that if it is what we perceive as negative, then it just needs to be shut down, right? And then what, just focus on the positive. But what I learned through meditation, and my practice of meditation is insight meditation, so which is where you sit in silence. You learn by going to a 10 days complete silent retreat. Like there's no talking, no watching TV, no reading, no nothing. It's just 12 hours pretty much of straight meditation, and you are not, you don't even talk through gestures. So if I'm opening a door and if someone is behind me, I don't leave the door, I don't hold the door open for them. I allow it to just gently go, and the other person is responsible for opening their own door. So I'm learning that meditation technique where you're observing cause and effect, and then the effect becomes cause to another effect, right? Like, so you're just that leading, which leads to action and reaction. So I do something and that leads to a reaction. That reaction becomes the action for the next reaction. And I'm just perpetuating that. So if I have not dealt with my anger, then if I become angry at my kids, then I'm going to continue to use anger as a way to communicate with them. But through that observation, I saw that that is where I understood that all these things that were happening to me, where I felt like I knew I had to observe, I truly understood why and how I was an observer, even in childhood, that I had to see these injustices happening. I had to experience these injustices. And then I was like I was this knowing person who didn't know what to do, right? Because I'm a child. So I had to be patient. And yet I had all this anger, and I became a wife, and I had to learn to become a wife. And then I became a parent, and I had to learn I had to learn parenting. And through all that, I had no idea who I was. I was just performing these roles. I had to have this family in my life, even though I didn't want any family. But it's not like I can just divorce family and say, okay, I'm done with you, and expect to be happy. That doesn't happen that way. And I also kind of knew that I had to fulfill all my duties and responsibilities in this life so that I can get to where I needed to be, or wanted to be, or desired to be at that. Initially it was desired, and now I know that I'm going to be wherever I'm going to be. I just have to do all the right things along the way. So then through meditation, I understood that this is more like the beach and the ocean. Like they are seamless in their in who in their being, right? Like when even if there is high tide and more of the ocean comes into the beach does not become a lesser thing just because of more water in it, on it. And the beach doesn't become more just because the ocean is receding, or the ocean doesn't become less as the low tide happens, as it recedes. So I had that kind of helped me understand that I am all of these things, that the more seamless I make myself of it, the better it's going to be. And through meditation, the other thing I realized was, understood and realized more in that realization sense, is that we all have laundry. We are all, our life is that laundry. There is some clean laundry, there's good laundry, there's bad laundry. If I want to clean out that bad laundry, I have to air it. Like it's not going to get clean just on its own. I just can't sweep it away. I can't throw it away. It is going to come back to haunt me. So the more I air it in a in a healthy way, the better it's going to be for me. That's when I found my voice.
When you're talking, I think about storm. That's like the thing that I reference the most is like a storm. Like if you're driving down a road and a storm comes, there's no way that you can go around it.
Yeah, an
The only way to
excellent
get out is
analogy.
through.
Yes. And you
And
wait a little bit, you observe what it's doing when it sometimes you can't drive through it, you just have to protect yourself from it. And at other times you have to go through it, but you have to go through it somehow or the other.
I want to get into your work and how you support people through cancer treatment. And how did you even start this?
So, like I said, I always knew I wanted to practice medicine. In India, that didn't happen. I came to America and found the PA profession. And I thought this is it for me because becoming a physician was, I became a parent early in marriage, had this extended family staying with me. I couldn't uproot everyone the way, medicine would have, the path becoming a physician would have required. So again, I waited for 10 years after I came here and I found the PA profession and I put my mind to it. Ignorance is bliss. I said, okay, there is a university an hour and a half away from me. I can commute every day. I can continue to be a parent. I have all these people around me and they will take care of my children. And I'm going to do it. And that was the only university. It was not an option. That was it. Like, I couldn't pick any other colleges or universities to go to because I wouldn't be able to commute to them. So I applied and I got in, fortunately, and it took 4 years of my life. The way I planned it was my son would start kindergarten when I started college, and before my daughter entered middle school, I would be done. So while they were still in elementary school, I thought that might be the perfect time. Had I put more thought into it at that time, I would not have done it because I know how much it affected my children. And my son would remind me, he was the younger one in kindergarten, "Mom, it's never too late to give up. Mom, it's never too late to give up." When I used to tell him, like, "I can't give up right now. I need to finish this." Ignorance can be a good thing. And it happens at a certain point in your life. So I became a PA. And then the next year, I came across this meditation technique where it was explained as 10 days of complete silence. You observe yourself. And I read more into it. And I said, this is what I want because I did not, coming from India where gurus are by the dozen, right? Like, and they can really exploit you. This organized religion can really make a mess of your life if we don't pay attention. And I had seen it at work. So, and also going to the boarding school where I almost converted into Catholicism, where I was encouraged to convert into Catholicism. But when you are not ready, when I call it, when you're not ripe enough to do that, then it can have all kinds of negative consequences to the psyche and to the young mind that hasn't developed yet. So I was seeing it in myself and I had seen how organized religion worked and all of that. So I did not want to be a part of that. So when this technique came in front of me, I said, this is what I'm going to practice. And so I thought PA school was hard. This meditation technique is even harder, but they both came at the same time. And I dedicated myself to practicing that because I knew that it would help me with my children. And I went in to become a better parent, and I realized I needed to become a better person first. I needed to heal. I needed to be kind inwardly so that I'm kind outward in my interactions with others. I began to see and understand all of that. It happened very, very slowly. It took about 15 years for me to understand what loving kindness was after I started meditation. But just the consistency of the practice is what got me there. And so I became a PA, and my first job was in oncology, but I always knew that I would be good at things where it's about life, where it's kind of more philosophical. So in that job, I started seeing dynamics, like why is it that some people with cancer, even if it is really bad, go through it with so much grace and ease? Versus people who have very, even if it's like a not so bad of a cancer, Why are they so angry? Why do they not do so well? What is it? What is happening here? So I was observing my patients as well. And I saw that, in the African American community, the role that the community and the church played and the way the patients were taken care of versus, like, in, say, the Caucasian, in the white community, where it's more nuclear, more, but there was more isolation there. And, some people didn't tend to do well through treatment in that group versus we, even though African Americans sometimes are more refractory to treatment, they still had that ease and grace and acceptance of whatever God gives me, I'm going to take it. They weren't afraid of dying. So I was seeing those kind of things just play out in day to day. And I was learning from them initially unknowingly, and then with more effort put into my learning and my healing.
Again, it made me think. It made me think about specifically my relationship with my community that involves, my friends, my church, everybody, and how we support people when they go through things. And especially, I have been very blessed to be a part of a group where mindset and combination with religion is very much encouraged. So having a perspective where you are very much capable and in control, and be mindful of what you're saying and the power of your words. Be mindful of what you're saying to yourself. Be mindful of what you're saying to other people. Be kind to yourself, like you said, so that you can be kind to others. Love yourself so you can love others. Walk in the way of love, respect, kindness, understanding. When you embody that, and when you are committed to walking that way, how that outpours on everyone. And I'm really a part of a loving community, and I have seen people
Awesome.
who don't necessarily feel well at times, or who are sick, be you wouldn't know because of their mindset and the encouraging mindset and support around them.
Correct.
So,
Yes.
yeah.
Preaching what you, I mean, practicing what you preach. Like, you have to embody that in order to make the changes in your life. And I started seeing that in medicine, especially. I was also seeing the dysfunctionality of the healthcare space, especially the people working in it, from the top to the bottom. And like a different, like how physicians, how they work and how it was impacting their life positively or negatively versus nurses, versus CNAs, versus admin people. It was just like I was observing that, and I was seeing how the dysfunctionality of healthcare, where it was happening, why was it happening? Because it's our own personalities that make that up, right? Like, I am the system. I'm not separate from the system. I make up the admin or whatever role I play in that, right? It's not separate from me. So my actions are going to reflect that. And I was seeing how then that impacts top down to the people who don't have the power. And that aspect of it as well was, I think also played a role in me giving me food for thought for sure.
That's amazing, though. I said a long time ago in an episode, oh my gosh, I can't remember the name right now. I'm trying to recall it, but I can't. I saw so in an episode a few seasons back, I think it was season two, maybe one, I had a conversation about how to properly advocate for yourself when you go to see your doctor. And the big piece of advice that I gave was see your doctor as a human, because sometimes we look at titles and that can cause confusion and make us look at a person as something greater than them being human, just like us, them having been through something just like us, them having experiences in life just like us, and how those experiences affect them. And so, first, look at them like a human and then approach the conversation in that way. So, that was like a big thing that I spoke about. That way you can effectively communicate your needs and hopefully get the treatment that you want to get. But that made me think about that too, when you're saying from the
They
top
have
to
to
the bottom.
listen too.
Yeah,
We
they
have, as
do.
providers, we have to listen too. So that's another conversation.
Yeah, but that I don't mind having. So, okay, I do want to get into what you said about selective hearing. So that is about selective hearing is about vulnerability and transparency. So can you share a personal or a professional experience where listening, because I feel like this transitions right into that, where listening with your heart led to a breakthrough?
I have both. At a personal level, I think one of my most pivotal moments feeling more at peace and at ease with myself was in a work environment where I was bullied for almost 2 years by somebody who was enabled by a higher up. So this person was more my peer, or like, which they weren't an APP, they weren't a PA, but they were somebody I worked with very closely at a nursing level. And then this person was enabled by a physician in constantly bullying me. And it was obvious to the entire clinic that this was happening. For 2 to 3 years, it just went on nonstop. And yet I knew that I had to stay in this place because there was a lot to learn, and especially from the physician who was enabling this bully, because he is the one who taught me that know your data, but always think outside the box when you're taking care of patients. And I think that is a very powerful, because if someone is receiving chemotherapy, if I am going to look at you just as somebody with all your side effects, everything that's happening to you as from that chemotherapy angle, then I'm going to miss a lot about what could really help you. So, like, you come in with fatigue, but if you are if getting chemotherapy, I'm just going to say that you have fatigue because of the chemo, but it could be fatigue because you're not drinking well enough, you have a lot of nausea, so you're not eating or drinking well there. You may be exercising too much, or you may have brain metastases, right? It could be the spectrum, and I miss that completely if all I'm saying is you're getting this chemo and that is why you have fatigue. So I knew that I needed to be in that place with that physician for however long it needed to play out. And the universe has always given me a kick in my behind to tell me when it's time to move on. So, and it happens through other people. So it happens sometimes through bullying, but at the same time, I've learned to surrender into it and trust it. Initially, I was more scared of it. So with this person, though, I came to a point where I, through meditation, I understood that one, I had to let go of my fear, whatever fear it was that I was carrying. And fear is most of the time so vague, right? It plays itself out, but we have no idea why we have that fear. What is it that we are afraid of? Because if I start digging into it, there's nothing to be afraid of it, right? So it's like, but it takes time to get there. It's not like just because I think it and I know it, like intellectually, it's going to happen. So I knew I had to get rid of that fear, and I knew I had to get rid of my anger and malice that I was carrying towards that person, which meant that there was anger and malice within me, right, towards myself. So when that happened, I was one day able to stand up to this person. And then the whole clinic rallied behind me, and we were able to get her moved out of the clinic. And so that was a huge winning moment, but it took 8 months to get there. So that selective hearing, there were so many parts. It was in some ways so subtle, right? But I had to hear all this and kind of sort it out in myself to understand it. And to me, that vulnerability. I had to become very candid and open and honest with myself, which is where that turmoil happens, and which is where that's the violent road to peace, right? Because ultimately it was liberating, and ultimately it had a peaceful ending because I didn't harm her. She just had to be moved out of the clinic, and I hope I wasn't like happy that I finally did this. Like, I was happy for myself. I wasn't, For the other person, you just don't want to have that ego saying that she finally met her, she got what she deserved. I hope I didn't do that. And then, at a professional level, I've had so many patients where I've kind of observed what is it that they are doing, who do they bring with them, how is it that they are processing the information that they have, especially when it is end stage cancer. I once told, so I had a patient with, she was young in her 30s with stage 4 colon cancer. And her husband did not really want, like, he was scared too, probably, of losing her. So he wasn't that involved in her care. So she turned to her pastor. And she and the pastor then became very, very close. And he was bringing her to her treatments. He was taking care of her physically. He was doing a lot of things for her. So they became very intimate. And we could see that play out when they came for their appointments. And it wasn't pleasant to see because we are uncomfortable, right? Like when we see a pastor and a patient having a relationship. But when we start looking at the back end of it, what are the reasons for that relationship? Then who am I to judge? Right? Like I know nothing, and maybe it's because of the pastor that the patient is getting the care that she receives. So then who am I to say that the pastor is doing something wrong? The pastor has to know whether he's doing something wrong or not. It's not for me to judge. But that is what I understood through this relationship. But as I was kind of taking care of them and seeing all these dynamics at play, she started slowly deteriorating, and deterioration at the end happens a lot faster. And they did not want to give up treatment. And he was kind of carrying her from the car into the wheelchair, into the room, and all of that. And I'm like, this is no way to live. So I had a conversation with the pastor, and I said, Are you holding on to her for your sake, or what are you doing to her and for her? Really question that. And he kind of pondered over it, whatever he did, and they stopped all care within the next few days, and within the week she had passed away. And then when he was, I don't know what the words are when they memorialize in the church, he was giving the eulogy. Like he kind of thanked me for helping him, kind of mo letting her go in a way in with love, not feeling like giving up, but it was more like surrendering and accepting and saying, okay, this is part of this natural journey, and it's if I want to help this patient, if I want to help her, this is what I have to do. And I feel like all of that is part of selective hearing as well. And of course, you have to hear your children all the time.
Yes.
Selective hearing.
And they have it too.
Right. No, but you
especially
don't
at
take it too
bedtime.
hard that they're kind of telling you something against you, right? Like if they're putting you in your place, then it's not out of like their intention is a good one, or maybe they're just doing it because they have the space to do it. And you hear that, you listen to that, and you see where there is room for growth, and you constantly grow from there.
Before I have you share all your information on how the guests can the guests, the listeners can reach out to you, I do want to ask you one more question, and that is, you emphasized during our pre-show letting go of dysfunction to achieve true health. And my reason for putting this in your package is because I recently, on my own journey, came to accept that if I really want this thing, I have to let go of all of these things. There's no way that they can work together. So for you, I would really like to know what that's like for you and in your treatment of patients.
At a personal level, because my mom lives with me, and I, even though there is no emotional connection with her. And when you are working through that, how you still want you, when you start, you still want that relationship, right? Like you're sad that you have to let go of expecting anything out of a mother. Because you still want that as a child. Until that is healed, it will keep coming up. That wound will keep opening up. whenever there's an interaction. So I had to slowly come to accept that it's okay for me to not be emotionally connected to my mother, and yet be, I have chosen to take care of her, have her stay with me until she dies. So I am going to provide her a safe place, her room, like whatever it is. She's going to have a safe place until she dies, but it's okay for me to have a very objective, non-emotional relationship with her. That's one example. So, like, just understanding and accepting that allowed me to heal so much, to the point now that I'm slowly, I only address her by her first name. She's not even mom. It just, I don't even feel like calling her mom unless it's to her face, because she's 83 years old and she's fragile, that I don't need to open up a Pandora's box for her with her emotions, right? Because I don't have the capacity to handle them. And I've come to peace with that. So that is where I've drawn the line, and I say, okay, I'm doing this. I have to let go of this kind of thing. And with my patients, I, through my talking with them, I don't have like a therapy session with them. It's not, that's not who I am, right? I'm not a therapist. But through the cancer journey, I'm asking them of their expectations. What are your goals of care? Have you really thought about this? Because in my space now, I also deal with people who want nothing to do with conventional care. And conventional care can be sometimes the best thing that can happen to them. And I tell them it's okay for you to not accept conventional care, to not go through that, but really know why you don't want that. And as cancer slowly keeps coming up towards you, with mortality closer and closer to you, know that you cannot backtrack. So at that time, what will you do? It's okay to not do it, and it's okay to die. We're all going to die. It's okay to choose how you want to die. But know that as death comes closer to you, you will not have an option to go back. So that is how I'm kind of working with patients, asking them to truly think about why is it that they're doing what they're doing, and why they're seeking this treatment or that treatment, or not this treatment or not that treatment, kind of thing. Because Dr. Google is playing a huge role in our lives to inform us, and now AI, and it's telling, and we are not experts in that. As a patient, I don't know medicine, so I have to trust my provider, because that they don't want to kill me, even if I may be cynical of the system that it kills people. Right, I still have to be trusting of my provider, saying that they have a good heart. So let me trust them, because they know their specialty. I know me. Let's meet somewhere in the middle by opening ourselves up, me listening to them, they giving them the space, and me giving them the space to tell their story. I listening to their story and making sure that it is correct in the way I've heard it, or at least the way I understand it, and then moving from that space. And not from a place of fear, and telling them, I will tell them sometimes that, look, you are not the expert in medicine. And if you distrust your provider, that is going to do you more harm than good. So decide how you want to journey through this. And the more we heal in this process, the better off it's going to be. And I tell them, we're all going to die. I don't have a problem telling people we are all going to
Yeah,
die.
very true. Someone once told me the only thing that's guaranteed in this life is change and death.
Correct. And not even taxes. We can
Yeah,
evade taxes.
yeah. But we can't escape that change is going to happen and that we're
Correct.
going to
And
die.
change is happening moment to moment to moment. Our conversation is changing both of us. Our conversation is not going to be the same the next time around, even though we may prepare for it. I'm just saying changes like second to second.
I agree. And I enjoyed this conversation so much. So before we
Me too.
go, let everyone know how they can reach out to you if they want to ask questions, specifically if this is the space that they're in right now, how you can help them on this journey.
So as a PA, I do have the medical, and I've worked for 20 plus years in the conventional oncology space. So I do have that experience to back me up. So that medical part of it, knowing cancer's behavior, knowing the treatment modalities, all of that is something that I bring to the table. Plus all the work that I've done on myself and just lots of training as well on the side, meditation, loving kindness, fasting, nutrition, so many other things, integrative oncology. Along with that, how do we understand cancer from the mind body spirit connection? So that is where I kind of came up with the model of the integrative SPI health, where SPI is the acronym for the four quadrants of the body, the spiritual, physical, intellectual, and emotional. And when those four quadrants are in harmony with each other, that is when we are in harmony with ourselves. And that is where healing happens. So how do we integrate it in a way that aligns with who you are, with your belief system? That is what I do. So it can be anywhere from the time of diagnosis through treatment and its side effects, how to mitigate them, and then into survivorship, how to continue to reduce the risk of recurrence, or even end stage, because talking about goals of care, talking about death, exploring death in a positive way so that it doesn't have to be scary and it doesn't feel like you're giving up, just all of those from the clinical as well as the mind body spirit connection is how I approach cancer. So I call it clinical coaching. And people can reach me by email, which is ispie at ispiehealth.com. So it's basically ispie at ispiehealth.com, or by calling or texting me at 980-224-0094. And I offer a free 15-minute introductory call where I discuss this model of care and how it may apply to them.
So everyone, you've heard that. I will also throw that information into the show details for you, and it will be provided on the resource page at selectivehearingshow.com. And again, I want to say thank you for being here with me today and having this beautiful conversation. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for giving me the space, and I enjoyed it thoroughly as well. Thank you, Julie.
You're welcome. And everyone else, I will be back next Monday with a brand new conversation. So until next time, this is Selective Hearing.